those feel like the X factors to me. Bringing jazz outside of jazz and approaching blues in a not obviously guitaristic way.
Welcome to the Banjo Studio Podcast from Banjo Studio, your source for the finest in North American-made banjos and Collins guitars and mandolins. Go to banjostudio.com on the web for an incredible selection of instruments and accessories.
Hello. In this episode, recorded June 18th, 2020, I'm speaking with Adam Levy, guitarist, prolific songwriter, producer, music educator, and music journalist. He has had an extensive recording career, which includes the notable Grammy Award-winning recordings by Nora Jones and Tracy Chapman.
So I thought I'd start in an interesting place, which is, I was actually, as I've been poking through your stuff yesterday, I was looking at one of your videos on The X Factor.
Mm.
And so your advice there was a very interesting to guitar players, which is to record themselves and listen to what they think is really the, I would say, I don't remember your exact wording, but the signature thing or the thing that is really important in their playing.
Mm.
And I was wondering what you think is your X Factor.
Oh, wow. Yeah, that is a good question. I think my X factor is maybe two things come to mind. One is a kind of jazz sense of harmony that can work in other contexts, like being able to think about harmony more colorfully because of, you know, my years of playing jazz and studying jazz. But finding ways to bring some of those sounds into pop contexts or blues contexts or singer-songwriter contexts without it feeling out of place or forced. So that's something that I think I'm able to do. And then the other thing is playing blues in a way... I've never said this out loud, so if I'm talking slow, and it's because the gears are turning. But I think there's something that I do that has to do with playing blues more like a piano player and less like a guitar player. Again, having something to do with harmonic sensibilities and not being so prone towards the minor pentatonic boxes that guitar players use, but just thinking more like melodically, harmonically, and something about that feels pianistic. It may come from just listening to piano players. One of my big influences was my grandfather, who was a professional pianist and arranger. So that's a big sound in my musical imagination is piano. So those feel like the X factors to me, like bringing jazz outside of jazz and approaching blues in a not obviously guitaristic way.
No, that's interesting. I want to come back to a couple of those genre specifications in a minute, but first, I did notice, and like a number of people that actually turned out to be some of my favorite players and musicians, that you studied with Ted Green and Jimmy and Mr. Weibel there,
right?
And I'm wondering, in light of what you said, how much of that, what was the impact of like Ted Green, who is all about somewhat similarly about notes and non-specificity of genre, and a deep look into jazz and that sort of thing. What was your experience with that? Is that somewhat influential?
Yeah. Oh, well, so much. Like when I went to study with Ted Green, and at first I wanted to have some questions to ask him, and, you know, not just walk in and say, "Hey, show me something." But, you know, I actually had a specific thing that I was interested in, and it had to do with, again, a pianistic sense of harmony. I was really into, at that time, a pianist named Don Grolnick. Do you know him?
No, I do not.
He was an interesting guy. He was somebody who played like with James Taylor and Linda Ronstadt, but then also played with John Scofield and Michael Brecker. And he was one of the only guys from Linda Ronstadt's kind of rock and roll band that followed along with her when she made the Nelson Riddle records, because he could hang with that stuff just as well. So he had a really particular kind of harmonic approach that I liked in his tunes and in the way that he played other people's music. So I went to Ted to ask about that kind of thing specifically, because I was baffled. I had no idea what Don Grolnick was doing. But over the course of a bunch of lessons with Ted, I think he realized, he probably saw my X Factor before I did. It's making me laugh to think about it, because he really, I mean, he was happy to show me the things that I was curious about that I was asking, but I think he saw that I really did like the blues, in a very broad way, not just one kind of blues on the guitar, but blues as a feeling. And he showed me lots of things that you could do, you know, playing a jazz version of the blues on the guitar, using all kinds of different approaches to the chords, really warm sounds. I think he saw that I liked warm sounds more than kind of shards of glass sounds. So there were lots of studies where you'd have like the third and the seven on the bottom, and then one or two color tones on top, and things would move chromatically, and there'd be this nice sense of voice leading. And also, I know there was at least one or two lessons I took with him that we really just sat and listened to records together. He was,
well,
the first time I heard Honky Tonk by Bill Doggett was in Ted's apartment in Encino. And I think he knew that I would really dig Billy Butler, the guitar player on that track, because Billy Butler was another guy who was like, it's definitely blues, but he had this beautiful sound, and there was a melodic sensibility and a kind of sophistication in his the way that he improvised and kind of built out his solos. And so, I think that my X factor, either I already had it and Ted recognized it and, you know, helped cultivate it, or, geez, maybe I was just a blank slate and he imprinted that. But my sense, just knowing Ted as a really insightful person and teacher, was that he saw that kind of natural thing there. Studying with Jimmy Weibel was really different, because Jimmy, I think, really was a great player and composer. I don't want to say he was not as good of a teacher as Ted, because I don't think that that's true. But Ted's X factor was that he really taught everybody differently. I know that because I sometimes would show up early to my lessons and I'd steal, you know, the last 5 minutes of the other guy's lesson, you know, before I got to my lesson. And I saw him really communicate very differently to different people. So that's why I say I think he might have had an insight into where I was coming from even before I knew it. Whereas Jimmy was much more like, here's this stuff that I've been working on, and I really believe in it, and I'm glad to show you as much of it as you can take on. I don't think he was as much about trying to find his student's X factor as trying to share this beautiful part of music and the guitar that he had spent a lifetime working on that was, you know, kind of uncharted territory.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, this is very, it's very interesting. I mean, I know I can definitely pinpoint besides you a couple of other friends I have that were with Ted Green, and they none of you play the same, and very, very good guitar players. So one is my friend Yogi Lanich, who's out there in LA too, and Phil DeGree over here, of course.
Oh yeah,
people who play very, very differently from each other. So I always consider that an excellent teacher myself. If it's very non-dogmatic, if they can teach people to be themselves.
Yeah.
So let's talk about the Shards of Glass thing for a minute that you brought up.
Okay.
Sort of continue up that direction. It's interesting to me. I mean, I've listened to so many of your records, really got through most of them and some of the rest of them. Over the last time since we said we were going to talk.
Okay.
And when I first met you, so you would you actually turned me on to Jim Campolongo, and I thought it was wild to hear one of Jim's pieces, you know, the great piece, The Prettiest Girl in New York, done by somebody else.
Hmm.
And but the sound was so different, like, you know, yeah, which is good.
Yeah.
Too. Yeah, really different. But again, I mean, in a way, you know, I mean, Jim uses an extremely trebly sound on everything. It sounds beautiful and very rich, but nonetheless extremely high-endy.
Yeah.
and uses a modified gear to do that. I mean, he's very open about what his gear is that he uses.
Yeah.
And I'm wondering, because you use, it seems to me on most of your records, you are you using all the built-in tremolo and reverb from amps that you have, or they're using outboard effects anywhere for this sort of thing?
When I'm recording, I almost never use pedals. I either use stuff that's, as you say, built into the amp. Like, for example, I'm trying to think of some examples. Well, there's a song on my record Washing Day that's called Breathe With Me, and there's tremolo on that guitar, and that would have been just right from the amp, which I think was my Brown Deluxe, my early 60s Brown Fender Deluxe that has great tremolo and does not have reverb. I've used that on a lot of records. Going back earlier, like I made a record a long while ago, an organ trio record with Larry Goldings and Kenny Wallison. Mm-hmm. It's called Buttermilk Channel. And the amp that I used on that record was an old Blackface Fender Deluxe that didn't have reverb. So in that case, anytime there's reverb, it would be something that was in the studio, like a plate reverb or a chamber. On a more recent record of mine called Blueberry Blonde, well, a lot of the sounds on there are acoustic guitar, but there's some electric guitar. I did use an old Boss VB2 vibrato to get kind of a pitchy vibrato on the instrumental song Blueberry Blonde. But when you hear other effects on that record where the guitar sounds treated, it's either... it's something made up in the studio, like using a tape machine to get a delay, or using a plate reverb or chamber or something like that. But I rarely bring a pedal board to make my own records. And I guess I do bring it when I'm a side person, because you just never know. And sometimes in the studio, you have to, when you're on somebody else's project, you have to move quickly. If it's your own record and you want to spend an hour getting some beautiful guitar sound, you know, working with the engineer to get this beautiful sound, that's fine, because you're paying for the time. But if you're on somebody else's record and, you know, they've got to record 7 songs in one day or whatever, you need to be able, it is more efficient to just press buttons and get sounds. But my inclination is not to do that. It's to used amps. One just kind of side note about Campolongo is that there is a record of mine called Loose Rhymes. It was the first singer-songwriter record that I made. I recorded it live at the Living Room, and
right.
I actually borrowed a blackface Princeton reverb, like a 64 or 65 Princeton reverb that belonged to Jim. And when I listen to that record now, my sound, I don't know if I would exactly say shards of glass, but there is more of that sound on that record than on most of my other records. And I think it's because, like you say, Jim modifies his gear and he has his stuff set up to manifest the sound that he's going for. And so when I listen to that record now, I really hear that sound, because it was Jim's amp that I was using.
Well, that must be a cool souvenir, I think. Or does it disturb you, or is it?
No, it doesn't disturb me at all. I love Jim's sound, and it helps. Yeah. It's a really, I have a great memory of recording that record, and I appreciate Jim lending me the amp. So yeah, no, it's all good.
Continuing on, if you don't mind, with because you brought up something else there that's very interesting. So, of course, it's written everywhere, and in your reputation, and their great accomplishments is that you're the guitar player on the Norah Jones record and the Tracy Chapman record, and those things that are on our radios every day now since the period where you recorded it. And I'm wondering, you've done so much stuff in the studio with other writers and stuff, and you just brought up a certain sensitivity to what their conditions are, and I'm wondering where you got the sensibility or the sensitivity to always be in tune with other people's material and what you're working with other people. It seems like a talent. Like, they want you there, and you're also really good at delivering it for them.
Huh. Well, thanks. Well, one thing is that's what I wanted to do from the beginning. Really, I never, when I started playing, wanted to be the lead guitarist in a band or be the singer-songwriter in the band. When I first started, I was really into the Beatles, and if anything, I wanted to be George Harrison. I wasn't keen to be the Paul McCartney or the John Lennon of whatever I was doing. So I liked that role from the beginning, just to be complimentary and supportive. And so the first, my first experiences in bands in junior high and high school was doing that. I mean, I sometimes would play a solo because if there was, if we were doing something that needed a guitar solo and I was the only guitar player, I'd play a solo. But I don't know. It's just that's how I got my whole falling in love with music wasn't like about shredding or lead guitar or anything like that. It was always I liked harmony. I liked counter lines and the kind of things, the harmony inside the harmony always intrigued me. And so I don't know that what you're talking about is something that I studied, or if it was just sort of because I had found my way into music from that perspective right off mm-hmm. the bat. It just felt always like a natural place to be. I don't know. Does that make sense?
Yes. Yeah, no, it does. I mean, I get the sense that you just, it is natural for you to do that, which is, that's like, how do people like to phrase that now? Your superpower. So that's pretty cool. That's pretty amazing.
Yeah. I wish I had a way to describe it or explain it better. Cause I mean, sometimes students will ask me about it, I get a couple of kinds of students over and over again, when I teach. And one type of student I see a lot is like somebody who just spent 4 years at a music school, like the New School or Berklee or someplace where they've been just studying a ton of jazz. And they get out and, you know, they get interested in other stuff and they start playing with singer-songwriters. Maybe a friend of theirs in the program is a singer-songwriter. And now they've got all these jazz chops and their friend is like, hey, I'm making a demo of my songs. Do you want to play on it? And my students will say, gosh, I just have no idea how to approach this. Like, mm-hmm. all of the stuff I've been practicing is pretty much useless for what is needed right now. And I try to get them to listen, just to really to focus on other aspects of the music, not trying to think about it from a jazz idea of like, well, you know, what are the changes or, you know, what, you know, like think about what the song is, what are the lyrics saying? You know, what is the songwriter trying to communicate? A lot of times when I do overdub set, like now I'm doing a lot of remote overdub sessions for people at home. And I always ask for a lyric sheet. I'd rather have a lyric sheet than a chord sheet. Because mm-hmm. the chords I can just kind of hear and react to in real time, or it's easy enough for me to sketch out a chart. But seeing the words, as a altogether thing, as a poem or a document, really informs me a lot about a direction that I might want to go in. You know, it's really, that's a thing when you're recording from home. There's no producer at your side. The artist isn't there to kind of guide you through it. So as much information as I can get about, you know, what the song is about, I try to get it. And I guess that's, in some way, that's what I would be doing in real time in the non-pandemic times when, you know, you're there and you're listening, you know, I think just trying to be a good listener and is really the skill, you know?
Mm-hmm. So in your own records, delightfully, really, they go from extremely sort of produced kind of sounds or bigger studio sounds to extremely humble sounding plain things. And I'm thinking of The Parlance of Our Times, which I don't know. I want to talk to you about The Parlance of Our Times because it seems like I couldn't tell if it was a tongue in cheek title or what, because I'm like, it's so many old songs done in a very plain manner, very beautiful sounding, but it's a very plain manner relative to some of your other records. So I'm wondering about that record, actually.
Oh, wow.
And things like that.
Yeah. So that record, I have to say, came about kind of accidentally. I had just moved to LA around that time. I was living in New York for a long time and I moved to Los Angeles and I really didn't have a lot going on. I hadn't met a lot of people yet. I wasn't going out to hear a lot of music yet. I was just kind of, for the first month or two or five or six or whatever, just unpacking boxes and just kind of slowly acclimating. And I needed a project. I felt like because I wasn't interacting with people regularly, I needed to just give myself a project. And I thought a good project would be to learn some old songs, public domain songs, things from the 20s and some earlier than that. I felt like there would be things I could learn from those songs that I could then take forward into modern songs, whether it's my own songs or just playing the guitar. I don't know. I feel like a lot of musical wisdom from that era is just lost on most music today. Even just simple things like using augmented chords and diminished chords.
The minor subdominant, which I hear you put in everywhere.
Yeah. So, right. So all of that stuff is just everywhere you look in those tunes in that music. So I wanted to just kind of steep myself in it. And it didn't start out as a record at all. I was doing it as a YouTube project. I just decided I would do a song a week for some amount of time. I didn't know how many I was going to do. I wound up doing, I think, 13 of them. And you can find them all on YouTube. If you just go and search on YouTube, Adam Levy Public Domain Project, they're all there. Uh-huh. And I was just recording them on my iPhone and making movies of them and putting them on YouTube. And I was having a great time. I made myself memorize them. So I wasn't reading. And I always included the verse of the, you know, like the kind of front piece of those songs is something that is often forgotten these days, you know. I mean, a lot of these songs, people mm-hmm. don't even play these songs. I'm talking about songs like Avalon and Let Me Call You Sweetheart and just really beautiful old-fashioned songs.
So if you're outside of New Orleans, where I am.
Right, yeah, right.
Here, we hear Avalon every day, but yes, exactly.
Right, exactly. So in Los Angeles, none of those songs the title really was ironic, the parlance of our times, because really nobody's playing these songs anymore. That actual phrase comes from The Big Lebowski.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah.
Wow.
Well, I'm trying to remember what it is. Oh, gosh. Yeah, the dude is talking to... he's talking about Jackie Treehorn and Bunny Lebowski, and he's talking he says something and he tries to walk it back by saying, oh well, you know, in the parlance of our times. The title was a Big Lebowski reference, but it was also just ironic because I really do love those songs. You know, Let Me Call You Sweetheart and My Buddy and all of those songs. So I recorded them. And then after a while, I felt like I was kind of overdue for a new record. And it just kind of hit me that, like, oh, gosh, you're already sitting on a record. You've got, you know, a dozen of these old songs. And the audio that you hear is just... my iPhone audio. I might have asked a friend of mine to do some kind of light mastering or something so that the levels were balanced, but it's for sure the most lo-fi thing I've done. I mean, I wasn't even using, when I say my iPhone, it's like, I know you can use GarageBand on iPhone, but I just mean I was just making video, you know, just shooting videos and then exported that audio and made the record.
Yeah, well, that's a great example of what you can do. You're just learning these songs, and I think it holds up. But it does sound lo-fi, but in a way that is, I think it delivers those songs really well. And then everything you just described about the intention, I think it really comes through that way. And but it is interesting because I think it did lay some groundwork, because I was checking out your latest thing, Smile, which of course is out of that period. I mean, you know, it's not, that's Chaplin's thing, and. So, you know, you're delivering the timeless Chaplin classic. And it's interesting to me the way that you do deliver those songs. So you deliver them deceptively, plainly. And because you're playing guitar like that, it's almost a folk style. But it becomes as ornate as anything from that period. And I was wondering, because the string arranging is killer.
Yeah.
And I looked up this fellow, Gorfain, and everything. And it's beautiful stuff. It really develops the song. And so I'm wondering how you've developed in that direction. I mean, it seems like you have the old songs and new songs now in a very sort of consistent mixture as we're going through things. I'm wondering how you feel that's developed, or did it impact you? You said you wanted to look into that, so you internalized it and it developed in you. And so how do you see that? I'm bringing up Smile because it's a very cool recording and with this such advanced string writing.
Yeah. Oh, that's a good question. You know, gosh, the stuff that I think I took away from those songs when I was doing the public domain project that became Parlance of Our Times was, you know, the kinds of things like you mentioned, the minor four and these kind of passing chords, and just kind of bringing that harm. I was already into that kind of harmony, but trying to bring it even more so into my playing. Like, let's see. I feel like somebody my generation, and I'll be 54 this year. You know, I'm younger than the guys who saw the Beatles on Ed Sullivan. I'm not that generation, but I grew up still listening to the Beatles, and then through my grandfather and through other sources, I got excited about music that was older music, and I always felt in a way more connected to that stuff than even to jazz. Even though I studied jazz, I think a lot of my harmonic, the stuff that I gravitate towards, the kinds of progressions, the kinds of lines and everything, is largely informed by a love for stuff that's even kind of pre-jazz or early jazz anyway. So my takeaway from working on those songs was maybe just a reinforcement of stuff that I already liked, but also kind of getting into more of the fine details of it, especially when I was studying all those songs to learn them. I tried to find old sheet music, and I would really look at the piano parts in the old sheet music and the passing chords and the counter lines. What I realized, because this is what I'm talking about, it's like my takeaway besides the nostalgia or whatever was like, there's just a lot going on these songs. You know, a lot of these songs were recorded on 78s in an era when, you know, obviously there's no overdubs. You've got a certain number of people in the room, and you've got maybe just a couple of takes, maybe just one take to get something really special onto this acetate. And so they're just action packed. You know, there's nothing, there's lines, there's counter lines. It's kind of never a dull moment. There's things are in motion. It's chords aren't big chunks of harmony so much as they're the result of things moving. You know, they're the result of lines. And, so I saw a lot of that, and when I looked at the sheet music, I saw some things that were really important parts of these tunes that people don't even do anymore because everything's been turned into lead sheets and real books and stuff. But if you actually look at the music, you could learn so much about what the bass line was or what the stuff in the middle, like what your thumbs would be doing if you were a piano player. And so I've tried to get that going in my playing, and it's something I'm still working on. You know, I listen to the way Randy Newman plays the piano, and he's got a lot of that kind of feeling. And the way Alan Toussaint played the piano, obviously there's things are moving. It's not just big clumps of harmony. Trying to tie this together with Smile. With Smile, that song, I just love the song. It grabs me every time. I can still barely sing it without, you know, tearing up still, you know. Yeah. But I wanted to have an arrangement. On the Parlance of Our Times record, I had to do all that stuff on the guitar and have all the stuff I was just describing about moving lines and stuff. But I thought it would be nice to just be able to sing the song and really play, as you say, kind of folk chords, campfire style guitar, and let the strings take all of that other stuff. And so, you know, my favorite string arranger here in Los Angeles is Eric Gorfain, and he has a group, the quartet. And so I asked if he'd be interested. And so we recorded two songs. We recorded Smile, and we recorded a song of mine called See No Evil. And I had never done that, but I had always wanted to do that. To me, that's such a dream to like, it probably started when I was a kid listening to Eleanor Rigby or Yesterday or something like that. But, you know, in my, you know, middle age or whatever I am now, like, I would love to do a record of, or a concert even, you know, someday when we can do concerts again and just play simple guitar and sing and have orchestra, you know, just harm. I keep coming back to this idea of lines and harmony. I mean, that was something my grandfather really impressed upon me. He was not interested in chords. He was interested in lines. And the, you know, the, his friends who were arrangers of, you know, professional arrangers, sometimes would just, you would write out the lead trumpet line from the beginning of the tune to the end, and then you'd write the second trumpet line, and then you'd write the third, you know, like it's, yeah. I went to music school, so I learned all these kind of hot shit voicings that you could kind of plug in when you wanted a certain effect. And that never occurred to him. Everything was just the result of things moving. And, you know, what better way to do that than with a string quartet? You know, it's just the perfect vehicle or the perfect tool to achieve that kind of sound.
Mm-hmm. So, in light of like a couple other directions I want to go, but I'm interested now, since you brought up your grandfather and the way that they looked at music early on, that I'm thinking in your background, where, let's see, where did really music grab you, and what was the kind of culture, the way music was presented in your family, which clearly was a musical family to you? What was the feeling of that?
It was both deadly serious and also shticky showbiz, all wrapped up into one. You know, it was like the most gourmet pizza you could possibly imagine, with, you know, heirloom tomatoes and morels and, you know, some rare sheep cheese, and then, you know, somebody just comes along with a can of Kraft grated Parmesan and just pours it on, or, you know, you know, like that. That's, it was kind of all of those things, because you know, it was taken seriously because it was how my grandfather had made a living. He came from just a working class immigrant family in New York. You know, his parents were from, were immigrants from Romania, and like at the turn of the century. And so he learned to play the piano, and then he learned to compose and arrange. And, you know, it was serious in the sense that it was the thing that elevated him and enabled him to have a comfortable life and raise a family and send his kids to good schools. And, you know, so it was very much serious and respected. And also he worked in television, which, even though television was showbiz, it was deadlines. I mean, he was the musical director on the Flip Wilson TV show. And he was the musical director on the Andy Williams TV show and lots of variety shows. And he worked his ass off, and there was always a deadline, and there was always stuff that had to be done. So I saw music as a professional thing. And then, you know, he would sometimes take me to recording sessions, and all these guys would show up early, and they were in shirts and ties, and they could read. And it, I, my whole idea of music, it wasn't from a place of like, let's just, you know, get in the van and go out and tour or be a rock star or, you know, I don't know what gets anybody to start music, but mine was, my first idea was just like, it's completely professional. And also there's plenty of shtick, and that's all just part of it. Cause, you know, he worked in TV, as I said. So music was kind of, in that era, in the late 60s, early 70s, there were still echoes of vaudeville. You know, there were still echoes of Our Show of Shows. And, you know, we, so that was really the culture that I came up in around music. And then little by little, I was exposed to other stuff. I remember seeing the movie Let It Be when I was probably 14 or 15. And that gave me a whole other idea of like, oh, this is what it's like to play music in a room with people. Mm-hmm. And this is what it's like to have a band. And this is what it's like to have a band where you're fighting. And this is, you know, what it's like to have a band where it sounds great together, even if you are fighting. And you know, you have really strong personalities. And that was like my first glimpse of maybe what my, you know, My musical life has really been both of those things. I've done plenty of sessions and just, I don't usually wear a shirt and tie, but I've tried to approach it with that same kind of level of show up early, be prepared, you know, thing, along with, it's also kind of a carnival, and you're dealing with creative people and artists and free spirits and people making something from nothing. And it's all of that all at once. Mm-hmm. I don't know if that's what you're asking, but that's what comes up.
Yes. Yeah. It's a beautiful picture of where you're seeing things from an early point. Do you have any ambitions? Is there any place that you're trying to get to, anywhere that you'd like to go?
Wow. Well, lately I've been writing a lot of solo guitar music, partly because I've wanted to for a while. I mean, I remember like probably two New Year's ago, I still make New Year's resolutions. They're so silly, but I do them just like it's a time to reflect and check in. And I remember like two or, you know, something like that years ago, one of the things I really wanted to do was write a bunch of new music for solo guitar, etudes for my students and also things to play. And that's been coming into focus. I mean, now in this time that we're in, I actually have more time at home, and I'm not so much into like looping or making a record of like a guitar orchestra. Like I'm happy to be able to work on stuff that really is performable as a, you know, one person, one guitar kind of thing. And, you know, I grew up at, there was a period of my musical growth that probably doesn't come through, but that was really important to me at a certain time, like in my late teens. I got really into all of this Wyndham Hill acoustic guitar stuff, like Michael Hedges and Alex Degrassi and stuff like that. And I listened to pretty much anything that I could find that was like that. I got some Pierre Bensuzan records, and I was just fascinated by what people could do on the guitar. And the two teachers that I studied with, who you mentioned, Jimmy Weibel and Ted Green, both were incredible solo players. Ted has a record called Solo Guitar. Jimmy Weibel made an LP called Etudes. And in the last, I don't know, 20 years or so, when I've played solo guitar, it's mostly been in coffee shops and, trying to be more providing atmosphere or something more than concert music. And in the last, since February, March or whatever, I've been writing more and more pieces. And when you ask if I have ambitions, like I would love to be able to play solo guitar music that's a concert, you know, and I have to find a way to do that. Because if you look at who's doing that today, like probably the first guy that people might know is Tommy Emmanuel, who's super incredible. But what I'm doing is nothing at all like that. So it's more understated and it's, Martin Taylor is somebody who does it. Martin Simpson is another guy. There are great practitioners, but I really have never done anything like that. In the context of a set of other music, I've done maybe a solo piece here or there, but that's kind of the thing I've been working on. So at the moment I'm trying to write music and play music that feels complete unto itself and that I feel I could play for people, you know, once we can play for people again. So that would be my ambition, is to build the solo guitar aspect of what I'm doing into something that I could perform and record and tour. That's a big ambition. And at the same time, I'd also love to do a little bit more side manning. And it's kind of a funny ambition because in a way it's backwards. I've already done a ton of that, but I quit doing it for a while. I left Nora's band in 2007 and I've done not a whole lot of touring with other people since then. But the last year or two, I went out with Liz Wright and I did a tour with Kat Edmondson. These are two really great singers. And it felt good to get back to that place of what you asked about earlier and just like being supportive and being part of the fabric. And so I guess it's funny that the two things that are most interesting to me at the moment are I have zero career as a solo performer. I would love to have a career as a solo performer, recording, touring. And at the same time, also get to do some things where I'm just part of the fabric with great songs and a great singer and a great band. I don't know, ultimately maybe write music, write some more music that would be for a bigger ensemble. There's a guitarist in LA, Anthony Wilson. Have you ever met him?
No, I haven't. No.
His father was Gerald Wilson, who was a jazz arranger in the 60s and 70s. And when I met Anthony in the late 90s, he had a 9-piece group that he was leading as a guitarist, which is pretty rare to have like a guitarist, a modern guitarist leading a big band where he's writing all the arrangements. I would love to do something like that as well. I don't know if it would be a brass thing or a strings thing, or if there was resources, it'd be great to do a little bit of both. Like that great Ray Charles record, Modern Sounds in Country and Western Music. Like half of those charts are with a brass band, and all that's arranged by Gerald Wilson, Anthony's dad. And then all the string stuff was arranged by Marty Paich. So there's kind of like two different sounds all folded together on that record. I would love to do something like that, I'll never, ever, ever be Ray Charles, but to be able to do something like that where I could sing and play and also write arrangements and have a full sound. I play a lot with a 3-piece band because it's economical and it's easy to get a rehearsal together, but I'd love to do some bigger projects, but that's just in my mind. The solo guitar stuff I really am working on every day right now, and the sideman stuff is kind of a moot point until touring ever happens again. So the thing that I'm closest to actually achieving, I think, is the solo guitar stuff. So maybe I should just focus on that for now.
Well, at least, it's easier to get the rehearsals right now.
That's funny. Can I take my mask off if I'm just practicing by myself?
It's a good question. You got to worry about the optics these days. Oh, that's very careful.
That's true. That's funny.
You got your guitar's opinion on that,
Yeah.
So that's that's interesting. And is there anything else you'd like to cover?
Gosh.
What'd you like to talk about?
Well, can I plug something?
Sure.
Okay. Thanks. I do a lot of online teaching, just in the regular way that you do, where people say, could I get a lesson? And you say yes, and then you book it and like that. But I've been doing this thing called Guitar Tips that started around the same time that I was doing those public domain songs, just as a way to have a project. And so this is a plug, but I'll also say it just to people that maybe they could take this into their own thing, whatever it's worth. It's like, you can always make a project no matter what. And so for me, I've always found that when the phone's not ringing, I make projects for myself and create stuff. And so I started this thing on YouTube that was called Guitar Tips. I did it for a few years. Just there's 100 and something free episodes. And then a couple years ago, I started doing it on Patreon. So now there's a thing called Guitar Tips Pro. And I do a lot of teaching there, which is kind of more conceptual teaching. I mean, it's not so much like, okay, put your finger here and now move the pick this way. And, you know, it's not so much that as it's like just stuff to think about and stuff that might inspire you or open some new doors. Because the teachers that I had taught me a lot that way. As I mentioned, like with Ted Green, like half of our lessons, I think, were just like listening to records and kind of talking about them. And it mean, you know, wasn't necessarily a barrage of chord voicings. Here's 27 voicings for C minor 7 flat 5. That's what you might think studying with Ted Green was like, but it really wasn't like that for me. And same with Jimmy Weibel. It was much more just like, here's some ideas and, you know, hope that you can find ways to make them your own. And so anyway, that's what Guitar Tips Pro is. And so that's a big, I forget to mention it sometimes when people ask what I'm up to, because I tend to talk about what I'm doing in, as an artist and, you know, creating stuff. But that's also something I'm doing, which is teaching. And I approach that also, I guess, like an art project as much as I approach anything else I do that way. So if people are interested in learning guitar looking at it through kind of the lens that I look through stuff at and finding stuff that they could take away and make their own, they could check that out.
I think that's a great, I think that stuff's great, by the way. I've seen some of those videos and I feel like I should stop in for a lesson, a bit of inspiration myself. But and I'm glad you brought that up, because you do you point things out very clearly. But of course, we started the interview on the X Factor, which is one of those videos.
Oh right, right.
I have one thing that I'd like to cover with you you know, I guess this would go maybe in the category of what they call these days meta. So you were somewhat of a music journalist too for acoustic guitar, right?
Yeah.
I think you did pieces for them and stuff. And,
yeah.
I remember when you were working on that. So what is it that you find interesting about digging up out of musicians and out of players? I actually have, and I'll disclose to people here, you once did a listening test with me that was published somewhere. So I'm wondering what it is you look for of interest in players and in music.
Oh, wow. Yeah. The stuff that's always interesting to me is the stories of how people got to making the stuff that they're making. You know, before I wrote for acoustic guitar, I wrote for Guitar Player. I was actually like on staff going in, you know, working in an office there for a couple of years. And then, Yeah, I've freelanced for Acoustic Guitar and Fretboard Journal and some other magazines. You know, the least interesting stuff to me was always the gear stuff. And you know, unless there was some great story about, you know, how a particular piece of gear came to be part of somebody's musical life, or, you know, yeah. And the music theory aspect was not always as interesting, just because I've already spent so much time in music theory that the stuff that I always tried to get into when I got to interview people was just more personal story. You know, like I got to interview Hubert Sumlin for Guitar Player magazine. This might have been like 98 or 99, something like that. And, wow. You know, I just was asking him how he got started, and he told me he found a Charlie Patton record in a garbage can, like this old warped record, and he didn't really know anything about it, and he took it home and put it on. And, you know, he told me, he's like, I listened to that. He said, and I said, that's what I'm going to do. And, you know, just the idea that, like, here's a guy, he just finds a record, an old warped Charlie Patton record in a garbage can. And then that leads him to develop this incredible singular voice on the electric guitar. And then, of course, influence so many people. Or, like, I got to interview Pat Metheny in the late 90s. He had just made a trio record with Larry Grenadier and Bill Stewart, I think.
Uh-huh. And I love that record.
Yeah. And so, you know, we got to talk about all kinds of stuff. And then I remember at one point asking him about his picking technique, which is, if you've ever watched his right hand, it's pretty unusual the way he holds the pick. And he said, well, you know, when I was a kid growing up in this little town in Missouri, like, there was no guitar shop to get picks at. Like, so you could get guitar picks like at the drugstore, the pharmacy or whatever in town. And he said, but all they had were thin ones. So I learned that if I kind of held it a certain way, I guess he actually, if you could imagine, like, holding a pick with your thumb and first and second finger, and if it was thin enough, you could actually kind of bend it a little bit, put a little kind of warp in it. And he discovered that if he did that, he could get this big warm sound that he was after. You know, he was listening to, you know, Wes Montgomery or whatever, and you know, he wanted to get this big sound, but all he could get was thin guitar picks. So he found this really funky way to make it happen. And I love the idea that he was just this resourceful kid who just wasn't going to be stopped. I mean, it says a lot of, you know, about the person that he became and is. It's like, even then, you know, some kids would just be like, well, I guess I'm just not going to be a guitar player because these are the only picks I can find and they don't sound like my heroes. So, you know, forget it. And he found some funny way to do it that worked and just stuck to it. And of course, you know, well, he's Pat Metheny, but then he told me that he sometimes thinks about, like, taking 6 months off and, like, studying proper picking technique and, like, redeveloping his whole thing. And it just, I was shocked. I couldn't imagine at this point in his career that he would want to do that, but he said it very seriously, you know? And so those are what's that?
Go ahead. Go ahead. Sorry.
Well, just those are the kind of things that I love, these kind of like origin stories. And then also just the very human stories of like what it's like to spend a whole life in music, you know? I mean, and as in the guitar player era, I really got to interview some incredible people. I got to interview Paul Burleson, who played with Johnny Burnett in the early rockabilly rock and roll trio, and Pat Metheny and Paco de Lucia. But it's just, yeah, the origin stories. And then this wasn't something I did for a magazine. It's just an experience that I had. But it's the kind of thing that if I were writing a story, I would talk about this. I got to meet John McLaughlin probably 20 years ago in New York. I just walked up to a friend of mine, and she happened to be talking to John McLaughlin in the East Village. And she introduced us, and I was like, oh, man, John McLaughlin. They were on their way to Tower Records, and they said, do you want to come with us? I said, yeah, sure. So I went. And I went upstairs to the jazz section, and they all went their own ways. And I was really, like, self-conscious, like, what am I going to buy that John McLaughlin would think is cool, you know? And we all kind of met up at the checkout, and I think I got, like, I don't know, a Grant Green record and probably some world music something or other. And my friend Lainey Stern, she was the one who was talking with John.
Wow.
She must have got something super cool. And then John got two records that I'd never seen before. I had no idea what it was. And I said, John, what are you buying? He's like, oh, I don't know, man. I just love these covers. They're so cool. And I love that, like, that's what was driving him, was he's just super curious and super open. And, you know, I was like an unforgettable moment for me, just of like, that's where he's coming from. And that we could all come from that place. And I definitely could stand to spend more time there. I overthink a lot of things, and the idea of just going into Tower Records and spending, you know, $20 or $30 on a couple of CDs just because the covers looked cool. I love that. I love that.
It's so amazing. It's funny. I spend a lot of time on his Twitter feed because he's always putting up stuff and talking in this way. And like as you said, it's very very plain that way. It's very funny too. Actually, we brought up because we could. I could start a whole publication called Right Hand Divergence, which is, you know, where guitar players really split up. And you just brought up three people that just don't pick anything alike from each other.
Yeah. Yeah. I got to say one other thing about McLaughlin, actually.
What's that?
Which does have to do with being a music journalist. I interviewed John in probably 8 or 9 years ago. I forget what the record he had out then was, but we were talking on the phone and he was so engaged and so turned on about music and having a cool, like we had a really cool conversation. And at the end, he knows I'm a player. He knows I'm not, you know, a non-playing journalist, but I'm a player and a journalist. Mm-hmm. And he said, you know, are you into the, he was kind of asking what I was into. And he was excited about this DVD that he had made a series of lessons about improvisation and modal improvisation. And he said, hey, what's your address? And I'll send it to you. And, you know, maybe that is not a super wild thing, but, you know, these kind of conversations, you know, I've had, you know, dozens and dozens of interviews with people, and you know, people might say, "Oh, yeah, let's keep in touch," and or I want to send you something, but like, you never know. And sure enough, like McLaughlin, like a week later, in the mailbox, personally from him, was this DVD, and I just thought that was really cool. He's, you know, like he wanted to do something, and he did it, and. It's not just like, hey, man, let me plug my new record and, okay, I got to go. I got another phone call at 1 o'clock to talk to another guitar magazine about my record. Like, he really, that was one of the most, like, engaged, real conversations that I think I've had. And that's the thing that I am always trying to get when I do interviews with people is not just talk about the stock stuff, but try to get it, you know, like, I mean, you're doing this too. It's like, try to get at the meta stuff or why are you doing what you do? How, you know, what,
yeah.
Where is it really coming from rather than like, oh, on the second song on your new record, you've got this cool chorusy tone. Like, how did you get that tone? Like, for me, that just kind of, those kind of questions never really get off the ground, you know?
Yeah. 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 Well, Adam, I think we covered a lot of ground, and I'm really happy with where we've ended up, and to get to talk to you again. So, if you're fine with things, we can at least call off the recording.
Absolutely.
Okay. Very good. Well, thanks for being with us.
Yeah, man. Thanks, Jonathan.
You've been listening to the Banjo Studio Podcast with your host Jonathan Frelick. Head over to banjostudio.com for a great selection of American-made banjos and Collings guitars.